You're listening to Avasant on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights into government-driven markets.
With Avasant on the Record podcast, I'm August Cole, writer-in-residence. We're joined today by Chris Meisner, a principal at Avasant Cyber Practice, focused on federal and private sector customers. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So DC Cyber Week kicks off October 16th during what seems like a really turbulent time for federal cyber. We see a growing threat to critical infrastructure, and the Trump administration's executive order has agencies starting to move forward, yet the National Infrastructure Advisory Council has fallen apart. So what does this all mean right now for federal civilian cyber spending?
Right. Well, obviously, there's a lot of layers to that question, and I'm going to stay focused on what it means for protecting the federal civilian, military, and intelligence networks themselves, because I think there's a lot of broader questions around critical infrastructure that we could have a whole other podcast on if you want to have me back. For the federal contractors themselves, though, I think what we're going to see is actually a lot of growth in budget, and then below that, a lot of turbulence below at the programmatic level, as customers are beginning to understand what the requirements are and are adapting some of the programs that they have existing right now to meet some of these needs. And that is, we're seeing across the board.
Let's look specifically at an agency like DHS. The Domino program, for example, had a very heavy protest cycle that put nearly $1 billion up in play until resolution this summer. Mm-hmm. What does that say right now about the competition in the DHS market and expectations about where spending is going?
Yeah, so DHS is fascinating, not just as an organization itself, but what it means for the broader civilian government. Of course, DHS has a mandate to protect the .gov domain, but they don't have authority. They can't force other agencies to do what they should or do what DHS wants them to do. The old joke that we keep hearing is, you know, no one ever gets put in OMB jail, and that's kind of the factor that DHS is dealing with. What we have seen, though, is a really exciting domino, with effectively a Einstein phase three, to really improve that fundamental sensor network that's out there, and so hopefully we get a lot of new data coming off of that. DHS is also working on putting together a dashboard to understand where the cyber vulnerabilities are across government and how up-to-date some of the software and software patches are. And then they're going to have to look at how to reinvigorate the Continuous Diagnostics Mitigation Program, CDM program. That one is probably what's most interesting, I think, to me and also to a lot of folks, because it has an impact not just on what DHS does, but what any federal civilian agency does. Most important here is the extent to which the Trump administration and Congress are willing to fund CDM in a way that really helps DHS not just show up and ask for budget, but actually show up with some solutions at hand that they can offer these agencies that really need help.
When they get to that point, what is the gap in time between idea and action?
You know, it's funny. I've actually asked a number of customers, I've asked a number of clients in the contractor world as well. Folks don't know, and I think that's the challenge, is that we don't have an average amount of time that it takes to go from hey, this is a good idea and what we need for protection, to something that's on the ground and actually working. I think the biggest challenge probably is defining success. I think a lot of times we come in with a sort of a higher level issue that we need protection against X, Y, or Z. And then it's sort of hard to understand exactly when we've achieved that. The cybersecurity is fraught with a peril of metrics. It's hard to measure success.
Do you expect to see some of those metrics coming out from the administration this fall?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. You know, in the last 4 years, by our analysis, federal civilian agencies, excluding DHS, have increased their cyber budgets by 20%. And we're expecting yet more increases on top of that. Now, admittedly, a lot of this is coming from a pretty low base. They weren't spending as much money as they should have beforehand. But what we're really excited to see is the results of some of this investment come through. And I think metrics are certainly going to be one of those areas. OMB continues to ask for them. Of course, DHS is working on ways to measure it. And then you see just a lot of variability between sort of the haves and the have-nots in the federal civilian world.
Shifting over to the Defense Department, you know, mm-hmm. cyber spending there seems like it's going just to be eating up more and more budget. Growth outpacing civilian spending in fiscal 18 at around 44% or so of the $98 billion pie that's been allocated. But where is this most meaningful from an industry perspective?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a lot of layered stories within the Department of Defense. I think, you know, if you look at the overall spend level, it's actually been relatively flat in the last few years. And so there's this narrative out there that cybersecurity is eating up more and more of the budget. What's happening is actually a few different things, August. First, on the enterprise side, we see a lot more commoditization. So we are in fact witnessing sort of, you know, rate competition on even basic cybersecurity jobs, and more commercial technology that's coming in and being able to do things more efficiently. What then we see emerging, though, is a lot of other interesting areas, in particular around Cyber Command and trying to build up the cyber mission platforms associated with Cyber Command. And then also thinking about the cybersecurity question in a DoD context in a much more rich way. So not just looking at the global information grid from an enterprise perspective, but thinking about tactical users, thinking about cybersecurity of a warship. These are questions that the department has started to ask themselves in a really serious way, and that's really where we see a lot of the funding coming to in the near term.
When you look at the cyber, you know, framework being more readily adopted by the warfighting community, mm-hmm. Special Operations Command looking at having more tactical cyber operators, for example, mm-hmm. and as you said, kind of cyber afloat. Mm-hmm. How does that, though, figure from a budget perspective in trying to untangle or unpack, you know, where growth is or where, you know, from a company perspective, where those opportunities are to make a difference?
Yeah, it's really challenging. You know, I have to say we've got a great analyst team here that spends a lot of hours poring over government budgets and trying to get to the ground truth of it all. It's complex, but I think it's complex in part because they're trying to move very fast, and we have to remember we're in a budget environment. We don't have a lot of flexibility, and we haven't for a long time. So in a continuing resolution environment, it's hard to get new starts. We've had a lot of CRs over the last few years. And so what happens sort of naturally is when you have priorities that are Secretary of Defense level priorities, which a lot of these are Secretary of the Air Force level priorities, you get a lot of alternative funding streams. You get other transaction authority. You've got a bunch of sort of, you know, side projects from a budgetary standpoint. It's creating a real headache for contractors and also for some of the you know, great government employees who are working to develop these tools and systems and platforms that we need. We are witnessing a little bit of clarity, though. The Air Force, particularly the 24th Air Force, has stood up to really take an initial lead on developing the core capabilities at Cyber Command needs. We've seen a lot of great work out of the service labs. You know, I think SPAWAR and AFRL really are standing a cut above. And then we're also noticing some of the large programs take this really in a meaningful way. You know, the old communications programs, traditional communications programs like a WIN-T, have taken this seriously for a very long time, but now it's starting to impact, say, the F-15 program office or the F-18 program office. Folks who haven't, you know, normally had to deal with the same kinds of cyber vulnerabilities that a network operator is sort of used to thinking about on a daily basis.
You know, from the operational perspective too, we've gotten used to having overseas contingency operations, right, funding things beyond operations, acquisitions, that right. sort of thing. Could you ever see cyber being rolled into something like that because of its operational relevance?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting idea. Part of the announcement to elevate Cyber Command to its own unified command, parallel to Strategic Command, was this idea around having an entity that can sit at the table and frankly speak up for itself in terms of budgetary needs. And that's really important from a just how government works perspective. What I think we're most interested to hear is the extent to which we're actually able to carve off a cyber mission budget that is separate and distinct from either the services budgets or from other programs that are out there. Right now, I think the challenge is that while Special Operations Command, which is the only combatant command that has its own budgetary, you know, title authority, Cyber Command's sort of a hybrid, right? It asks for some things and gets some things directly, but it also relies very heavily on the services to train and equip, which is their traditional mission. And I think at the end of the day, I think the elevation of Cyber Command is going to help in the long term to try to clarify the budget environment for cyber spend, especially on the offensive side.
You know, speaking of clarity, we've had some really interesting revelations in the press around leaks of intelligence community cyber tools.
Right.
Which is one of the rare ways to get a read on where the priorities are in the IC. Right. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. You know, obviously we have to be careful in the open environment. You know, how much we talk about this. I think it's fair to say from publicly available information that if you look at the capabilities that were lost, any reasonable person can understand that these were significant capabilities. These were access. These were collection capabilities that we needed. We needed to keep ourselves safe from a national intelligence perspective, and those are going to have to be rebuilt. Cyber has a refresh cycle anyways. You know, any off the street hacker will tell you the exploit's only good for, you know, until the next, you know, Tuesday patch day comes out for Microsoft. So these things have a shelf life naturally anyways, and so there's always a refresh cycle there. But I think, you know, one of the things that we're expecting is to see a real growth in spend from those core kind of IC customers around trying to rebuild some of these capabilities that were compromised through the leaks.
Are you seeing a larger pool of companies competing for those dollars?
Yeah, you know, this is interesting. I think, you know, again, it is somewhat difficult to tell, but, you know, one of the things that talking to some folks who are familiar with that kind of market landscape, you know, they've started to witness, you know, not just smaller companies kind of raise their hand saying, hey, we have a white paper, we think we, you know, can really add some interesting capability, but also more importantly, I think some of the best talent leaving the big companies with an idea of, you know, I'm going to start a company that can really address some of these challenges. I would not be surprised to see another, you know, 5 to 10 $75 million cyber companies in the DC area in the next 5 years who grew quite large on helping first and foremost solve these intelligence problems, and then of course expanding to some of the broader cybersecurity problems in DoD and federal civilian and even commercial customers.
Can you see a lot of cross-market continuity in cyber?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's interesting. As much as there is a historic tension in the commercial cybersecurity market with the government, you know, ever since the Clipper chips and the NSA trying to squash commercial encryption, at a personal level, you know, what you tend to see is the folks that Apple, that Google, that Ford hire as their chief security officers tend to come out of government. And so I think there's a recognition that there's a great amount of expertise within the DC area. You know, Maryland's trying to cast themselves as the cyber Silicon Valley or some, you know, terrible turn of phrase like that. What hasn't happened yet as much, and I think we'll kind of have to wait and see, is the extent to which those capabilities of the companies that serve the government can come out to the commercial world. What we are seeing, though, right now is those great commercial companies come into government with some new ideas and some new platforms. Frankly, just some new approaches to help try to solve problems that we're dealing with. And you know, it's really interesting to think about, you know, all the way back to the beginning of commercial encryption, where, you know, we got dramatic improvements of encryption, mostly because the commercial world thought about things very differently than the government does. And I'm really excited to see that.
You know, on the healthcare side of things, which seems to have a lot of intersection between different threat vectors, but also political and organizational challenges right now, how do you read the prospects for healthcare.gov and, you know, for companies that are in that space? You know, there's this question of challenges and opportunities. You know, how is that balance tipping right now?
Yeah. I mean, gosh, it's really tough. There's the old mantra that security is the first thing to get in the way of innovation. And so, you know, every time you're trying to do something new in the digital world, you're just trying to get it done, trying to get it working. And then security is kind of an afterthought. And of course, any good security engineer will tell you have to bake in security from the very beginning, or it's hard to bolt it on afterwards. I think looking broadly across the health IT world, and also looking into customers like HHS and the VA, and also the military health system, we're starting to see a real focus on cybersecurity, frankly, from the beginning. I think they're beginning to understand the importance of baking that in from the start. Whereas historically, and I won't name names, but let's just say there was a very senior program manager in HHS a few years ago when I asked about healthcare.gov, and I said, you know, what is your cybersecurity budget, and how are you thinking about cybersecurity in the rollout? And they just said, we're not. And I mean, that was really telling to me that, you know, at least there was some honesty in the room. But you know, it is something that the civilian customers, especially on the healthcare side, have had to kind of come to a reckoning that they are vulnerable, and not only that, the information they have on all of us is really valuable to sort of would-be actors out there.
It seems from a national security perspective, you can make a case that it's as critical as any other bit of data set out there in terms of intelligence collection, let alone operationalizing that.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at just the recent breach in the commercial sector with Equifax, where potentially 40% of Americans had, you know, I don't know, I just bought a house myself, and that credit report is scary good and detailed about what the information they have on you and Equifax and TransUnion, et cetera. Now imagine if we can layer on top of that the only things it seems like the credit unions don't, or credit reporting agencies don't have, which is your intimate health details. This is really valuable information, especially if you're trying to think about access. And I think what folks need to understand is that, you know, okay, so I lost, you know, grandma's healthcare records. Well, the issue isn't always grandma. And of course, her cybersecurity matters and her digital privacy matters. But the problem is you know, who's the grandchild? And is the grandchild a senior DoD official or somebody who has access to a senior DoD official? Can I hack grandma and get to that guy and then eventually get to where I want to go, all within sort of a chain of digital trust? that's now been violated in some way. And so I think we're beginning to realize that anytime we have a lot of real people with digital identities, we need to protect that, you know, that store of information as well as we protect anything.
Yeah, the compounding risk of that data being aggregated and combined with machine learning is pretty frightening.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Chris, it was great to speak with you.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
To listen to more of the On the Record podcast, you can find us on iTunes or at avocent.com.